This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Yaki on Liberalism, Part 2. My last installment, I got a comment from Rusty, a longtime commenter at my blog, who had recently recommended Yaki's wisdom on liberalism, and may have been the first one that recommended it to me years ago. He summed up his view of liberalism, and I'll read it here because it's another example of one of the characteristics I've noticed of liberalism, which is that it's lots of different things. Almost everybody has their own idea about what liberalism is, but this has something in common with what Yaki himself has to say and what we'll get to this time. But what Rusty wrote is, the more degenerate our society becomes, the more it seems to me that liberalism and sin are practically the same thing. The fountain of both are the same. The belief that one can break the rules of the universe and of gods and not have to face any consequences. All other errors, sins, follow from this basic rebellious notion. I see a connection there to the idea of liberalism that liberals don't take their own side, and specifically because they see no threat, they see no consequences, or they see no other side. Everybody is us in a liberal mind. There is no us and them. There's just us. So there's no side to take. But this is interesting in that it, just to paraphrase it, it sees liberalism as a violation of natural law. And the interesting thing about that is that life itself, this is getting a little deep now, but, you know, life itself can be seen as a challenge to nature and to natural law. Although I think the meaning here, the idea is that life has to challenge nature in order to continue to exist. But I think in Rusty's idea and what Yaki talks about is that when you go against nature's law, when you violate nature's law, is when life goes off the rails. Life has to struggle to survive, but it has to live within the bounds that that nature lay down, the laws that nature lays down. You know, but one of my own responses, or you know, the first thing that comes to my mind when I read Rusty's description here about this belief that you can break the rules of the universe, is what drives this rebellion? What is it? What's the motive, the motivating factor behind it? And that's where I think this way of seeing it kind of falls short, in that there's no cause. It just is. Who's driving what we call liberalism today, this compulsory freedom and equality that this liberal system enforces now, forces upon us, forced integration, open borders, that kind of freedom, that kind of equality. Whom, in other words, I think is at the root of it, of understanding what everyone calls liberalism. And that fits just about any definition of liberalism, is you can see how whom is either figuring into what they're talking about, or that they're overlooking the whom aspect, the fact that it involves one group of people against another. And this too will come out a little bit in what Yaki has to say about it. Now, the last time I wrapped up by just introducing the topic and talking about the very last thing I talked about was this upcoming biography coming up that Ted Salas was talking about, anticipating. And he said that Yaki was likely troubled by the idea of disjunctive, subracial, for example, Nordic, Alpine, Mediterranean, European subdivisions that considered these putative subraces as almost different species, with implications of superiority slash inferiority. As a promoter of European unity, Yockey eagerly latched on to the absurd Boasian countertheories to invalidate what he saw as invidious and divisive distinctions among Europeans. The interesting thing about that, I think, is that it gets to liberalism as it was first expressed in its earliest expression in the early 1800s, late 1700s, was the beginning of the obscuring of racial distinctions amongst Europeans. It was about broad-mindedness and not being bigoted, you know, tolerance, and specifically toward minorities. It was the beginning of anti-racism, the beginning of the idea that everyone is us. And yet Yockey, at least for Europeans, fits that liberal mindset in that he wanted Europeans to think of themselves as one big cohesive whole. And as a promoter of European unity. Anyway, this observation of him, though, we'll get to here in talking about some of the pages leading up to where Yockey actually talks about liberalism. I want to start with a little bit of some of his other ideas that are related to liberalism, and sort of to make sense of what he has to say about liberalism, we have to explore some of what he says a little bit earlier in his book. There's some practical difficulties in reading Yockey aloud rather than just reading him with your own eyes. With your own eyes, you can see the how things are emphasized or punctuated. He often puts quotes around certain words, as I often do, or italicizes certain words, capitalizes certain words to give them special meaning. And where I think it's critical, I'll note those things as I read them. But it does make it a little harder to maybe get the full meaning without reading it yourself and having it read to you. He also has his own unique terminology, and that's why I think it's necessary to read a little bit, to rewind a little bit in his book before he actually talks about liberalism itself, to get a sense of some of that terminology of his and what he means by it. So what I'm going to do is read here from his book, starting at page 152. This is Imperium, chapter 2, page 152, in a section titled The Laws of Totality and Sovereignty. Sovereignty. And he's speaking here specifically about what I would call group identity, although the organic nature of it is very important. He writes, "The organic laws of sovereignty and totality refer to all political units whatever. They describe any unit, whatever its provenance, that reaches the degree of intensity of expression at which it participates in a friend-enemy disjunction." That phrase is important. It's really the definition of the kind of organism that he's talking about. And this is goes to the point about the sub-racial categories of Europeans and why he didn't like that idea, why he wanted to consider Europeans as a whole. Totality refers both to issues within the organism and to persons within the organism. Any issue within the organism is subject to political determination because every issue is potentially political. Any person in the organism is existentially embraced in the organism. Sovereignty places the decision in every important juncture with the organism. Both of these laws are existential, like all organic conditions. Either the organism is true to them or it is faced with sickness and death. Both laws will be explained. I'll break in here to say that this is where Rusty's violation of natural laws comes up, that it's related to what Yockey is, the point that he's making here. He's saying basically that these political organisms, what I would call group identity, although he's very specific, by calling it an organism, he's saying that it's a biological entity. It's rooted in biology. He's basically talking about racial groups without using the word race. By using the word organism, he's implying that that's what it is. Although in a looser sense, maybe, than what some people, including myself, think of as race being very strongly rooted in biology, whereas Yaki apparently had a more spiritual side to his idea of race, as well as biology. But the important point here that he makes is that the consequence of breaking these laws that he's going to describe is death. It's sickness and death. First, the law of totality. Any contrast, opposition, or hostility, whatever existing within groups among the organism, may become political in its nature. If it reaches the point where a group or a unit feels another group, class, or stratum to be a real enemy. For such a unit to arise within an organism is for the possibility of civil war to be present, or a severe crisis in the organism, which renders the organism liable to damage or extinction from without. He italicizes this part now. Therefore, every organism, by its very existence, has the characteristic that it assumes power over the determination of all issues. End italics. This does not mean that it plans the total legal, the total life of the population, economic, social, religious, educational, legal, technical, recreational. It means merely that all these things are subject to political determination. Many of these things are neutral to some states, but objects of interest to others. But all organisms will intervene when an intergrouping may possibly become a focus of a friend-enemy disjunction. This describes all political units, whatever, entirely independently of how they formulate their written constitutions, if they have any. So he's speaking in very, very general terms here about this concept of group identity, or call it political organism identity. And he's talking specifically in this section about this, what you could call factionalism, this tendency for subgroups to exist. And if they become too well defined and too acrimonious, that they can cause a civil war. They can cause the breakup of the political organism. It's all pretty straightforward when you think about it, but you do have to think about it. You know, just if I were to just read this without stopping and digesting it, even in my own head, you know, before I sat down to do this, I had to read it several times to try and get the idea of what he's describing here. It doesn't. He's very clear in what he writes. He uses very simple concepts, but you just have to understand that he's trying to generalize here. He's not talking about any one specific state or government or people. He's talking in general terms here, although I suppose it's specific to Western man, to the white man, to Europeans. He continues, the law of totality affects individuals by embracing them existentially in the life of the organism. Politics places the life of every man within the political unit in the balance. It demands, by its very existence, the readiness of all individuals in the service of its fulfillment to risk their lives. Other groups may demand dues, periodical attendance at meetings, investment of time in group projects. If they demand, however, so fundamental is this organic law of totality that the member plight of his life to the group. That doesn't seem to make any sense when I read that. I wonder if I copied and pasted something wrong there. Basically what it's saying though, that if they demand the life of the member be dedicated to the group, that they become therewith political. So by definition, the group becomes a political group. And this is where his specific and unique terminology comes in. He's saying that by definition, a political organism is one in which the members of the organism actually pledge their lives to the political organism. He continues, the French public law professor Horion designated it as the hallmark of a political unit that it embraced the individual entirely, whereas non-political groups embrace him only partially. This is the law of totality, in other words. It is thus a touchstone of a group for this purpose, whether it demands an existential oath. If a group extracts such an oath from it, from members, the group is political. This law of totality, it is hardly necessary to add, is not at all derived from conscription for military service. Conscription exists only for a few centuries within a high culture, whereas the law of totality describes the culture itself when it is itself constituted as a political organism. And during the period of concentration of politics in culture states, it describes every individual state. Like all organic laws, it is existential. If any inner force can challenge it, the organism is sick. If the challenge is attended with success, the organism is in severe crisis and may be annihilated. In any case, its unity may be temporarily in abeyance, with the possibility of partitioning by outer powers. The law of sovereignty is the inner necessity of organic existence, which places the decision in every important juncture with the organism, as opposed to allowing any group within to make the decision. An important juncture is any one which affects the organism as a whole, its steering in the world, its choice of allies and enemies, the decision of war and peace, its unchallenged inner right to decide controversies. If any of these can be called into question, it is a sign that the organism is sick. In the healthy organism, this sovereignty is absolutely undisputed and may continue so for centuries. But a new age with new interests may raise contrasts which the rulers do not grasp. They may blunder and find themselves on the defensive in a civil war. The challenge of the sovereignty of the organism was the first symptom of crisis. If the organism survives the crisis, the new rulers of the same organism will be the focus of the same sovereignty. So he's shifted now from talking about the law of totality, that individuals have to basically swear an oath and put their lives on the line as part of a political organism, and in order to keep it whole, because it can otherwise be divided and conquered, even if it's only by ordinary, normally occurring factionalism, or if it's stirred up from the outside. Either way, it will lead to the death of the organism. And here he's now shifted to talking about the law of sovereignty, basically who has a say over what the organism does. And he says the organism as a whole, kind of an obvious thing. But what he's getting at here is what we call today, what Kevin MacDonald has referred to as the Jews as a hostile elite, the situation that we're in now, where we have this rule by an implacably hostile minority that really has an animus for the quickly shrinking majority white population. And as Yaki predicted, it leads to the organism dying. And the first symptom of that crisis is the signs that the organism wasn't healthy. It was that its sovereignty was disputed. It's the idea of who its choice of allies and enemies, the decision of war and peace, all of these factors that he's referring to, these general factors. You can certainly see that playing out in the history of the United States as the white liberal men who founded the country lost control of it over over the course of time to the Jews. An important fact, continuing with Yaki here, has been touched on, upon with this. It is not the rulers who are sovereign within the meaning of this law. Their powers, in fact, are derived from their symbolic representative position. If a stratum represents and acts in the spirit of the age, he capitalizes that term there, spirit of the age, revolution against it is impossible. An organism true to itself cannot be sick or in crisis. And here, I interjected too soon there about the hostile elite. He's making the point about if the rulers are actually the rightful rulers, the legitimate rulers, they're symbolically representative of the whole, and they act in what he calls here, what Yaki calls the spirit of the age, then revolution against it is impossible. Now, spirit of the age is the English phrase for a more common term, which is Zeitgeist, a German term, which means time spirit. Literally, it's the two words glued together. It's a philosophical term associated with Hegel, Herbert Spencer, Thomas Carlyle, all of whom Yaki himself mentions as he's talking about this political philosophy. Elsewhere in the book, he mentions all of those names and more. But he uses the term spirit of the age rather than Zeitgeist. It's they're pretty much synonymous. But here we get to, you know, the philosophy of society. My view of liberalism, what I've talked about in some of the earlier installments on liberalism, you know, is the idea that this ever-changing beast that we call liberalism over the course of time, as it has completely mutated and changed in its meaning or in what people attribute to it. My understanding of that was that liberalism is not this thing frozen, this set of particular things that are can be identified, but instead that the nature of liberalism is that it's the philosophy of society. Whatever the dominant philosophy of society is, we call that liberalism. Although, of course, it started at a particular time, and at a certain time, things will have changed so radically, and the people in charge will have changed so radically that I think that they'll give up even pretending to call it liberalism anymore. Most people, when they use the word liberalism, it's implicitly, if not explicitly, associated with whites, with Westerners, with Europeans. It's a European thing, liberalism is. It springs from within us. And that's the sense in which most people use a more specific the term more specifically to mean specifically how white people are behaving and why they're behaving that way, what they're thinking, what's going on in their heads. And that's what Yaki too is referring to as liberalism. It's the irrepressible expression of or a certain strand of European personality coming out. He continues, the law of sovereignty does not mean that every aspect of group life within the organism is dominated at all times by the political, nor that everything is organized, or that a centralized system of government necessarily reaches out always and destroys every organization of whatever kind. The outlook developed here is purely factual, and the law of sovereignty describes all political organisms. It is a formulation in words of a quintessentially characteristic of a political organism. So what he's saying there is what I've already anticipated and described, is he's making a generality here about what he's defining as political organisms, what their characteristics are. And he's saying that these two laws, the law of totality and this law of sovereignty, are the two characteristics of these organisms. These are the defining properties of healthy political organisms. And when you violate those two laws, when you deviate from them because you think you can with impunity, the consequences are sickness and ultimately death. And so now we're ready to move ahead, skip ahead. That was pages 152 through 155. And we skip ahead now to page 204. And this still is not the section that Yaki titled Liberalism, but here he starts to speak specifically about liberalism. So we're getting closer now to the topic at hand. This is a section titled The Two Political Anthropologies. The touchstone of any political theory, whatever, is its attitude to the fundamental ethical quality of human nature. From this standpoint, there are only two kinds. Those which posit a, quote, naturally good, unquote, human nature, and those which see human nature as it is, on the other hand. Good has meant reasonable, perfectible, peaceful, educable, desiring to improve, and various other things. Every rationalistic political or state theory regards man as, quote, unquote, good by nature. The encyclopedists, the Illuminati, and the devotees of Baron Holbach's philosophy were all symptomatic of the advent of rationalism in the 18th century. All talked of, quote, the essential goodness of human nature, unquote. Rousseau was the most forceful and radical of the 18th century writers in this respect. Voltaire set himself apart by denying totally this essential goodness of human nature. So he's making the point here, in Yaki's view, liberalism is based on this, what he regards as a totally false premise that human nature is inherently good. He's ridiculing it, basically, the idea. He continues, it is curious that a theory of politics could ever possibly ground itself on such an assumption, since politics actualizes itself only in the form of the friend-enemy disjunction. Thus, a theory of hostility assumes that human nature is essentially peaceable and non-hostile. I sense some sarcasm there in his tone. He's saying that, and as I've said earlier, liberalism is this delusion that everybody is us, that everybody's peaceable and non-hostile because everybody is us. We have no them to worry about. We don't take our own side because there is only one side, everybody's side. Yaki continues, the middle of the 18th century is the beginning of the word liberalism and the idea complex liberalism. Since human nature is basically good, there is no need to be strict with it. One can be liberal. This idea was derived from the English sensualist philosophers. The social contract theory of Rousseau originated with the Englishman Locke in the previous century. All liberalism predicates a sensualistic, materialistic philosophy. Some philosophies are rationalistic in tendency, and liberalism is simply one variety of politically applied rationalism. So he traces liberalism here, as we've previously seen, to the mid-18th century, 1700s. He identifies Locke as probably the primary philosopher behind it, although Locke's ideas came down through Rousseau a century later. Another central figure there, Locke and Rousseau. Liberalism is sensualistic, materialistic, and rationalistic. And we'll talk more about the rationalistic aspect the next time.